Welcome back. It's been exciting to see how this forum has evolved from an idea and three of us chatting one day in a little coffee shop in a mall about whether this could happen, and here we are today. And it's just quite phenomenal to see how I believe God's hand has worked in this. The session that we're going to go into now is looking at you and I, people in our everyday walks of life, and how does faith intersect with healthcare for us? People of faith have perhaps always lived at that intersection. Dr. Kenny spoke to us last night about the origins of medicine being the integration of scientific and spiritual thinking back in the time of Hippocrates 2,500 years ago. What was probably the first public institution devoted to the free care of the sick was founded by St. Basil in the 4th century. And as European immigrants began to settle in North America, it was the faith communities that brought health care to serve the people. From members of the Episcopalian Church in what is now New York to the work of the Catholic Church, it was the faith communities that established hospitals and provided care for the sick. The first hospital in the U.S. was built by Dr. Bond and his friend Ben Franklin. Dr. Bond was a Quaker. And in Canada, it was the faith communities that established many of what are today the long-term care facilities that dot our province. And they were established by many of the faith care communities: Catholic, Lutheran, Anglican, United Church, Mennonite, Salvation Army, the list goes on and on. It was the faith communities that provided care for our elders. Our speakers this morning live at that intersection of faith and healthcare through both their vocations and their experiences. And we're going to be hearing from these five people, and I'll introduce them as they get up to speak. But at this point, I'll just tell you who they are. Reverend Craig Wendland, who's the chair of the Bethany Group in Camrose, a long-term care facility coming out of the Lutheran tradition. Carol Barwick is a hospital or a hospice champion or chaplain here in, and a champion as well, here in Calgary. Dr. Peter Neiman is a pediatrician here in Calgary, and Deb Zimbel is a parish nurse. Jerry Carter has followed a vocation that has taken her to address issues of the broader determinants of health that we heard both Dr. Kenny and Dr. Swan touch on. And she's also going to be speaking from the patient perspective. Each speaker will have up to 10 minutes. They may take that, they may not. We've sort of given them varying time frames. So we will, and we will also have a time for questions afterwards, and then we'll move into some group discussion. So I'll begin by introducing Reverend Craig Wendland. Reverend Craig Wendland is a Lutheran pastor and serves a Two Point rural parish in Hay Lakes, Alberta, which is near Camrose. For the past 7 years, he has also served on the governing board of the Bethany Group, the last 2 years as chair of the board. The Bethany Group is a faith-based health and housing corporation which works primarily in the Camrose area and is related to the Alberta Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada. In terms of health services, the Bethany Group is known for its operation of all the continuing care spaces in Camrose, and it also operates the Rosehaven program, a provincial program for people in continuing care who have behavioral problems. In the past 7 years, Craig has learned a lot about the intersection of faith and health in Alberta and is looking forward to addressing this assembly.
Thank you, Barb. Last night, I believe Dittmar introduced Jean Morris of Bethany Care Society here in Camrose and said not to be confused with the hunger strike. You can confuse me with the hunger strike, woman. And so I will comment briefly on Marie Geddes and her cause today as well, too, the feisty and determined woman who has brought to national attention some of our concerns and to continuing care. And as Barb mentioned, The Bethany Group is a faith-based, not-for-profit organization in Camrose. And when we consider the intersection of faith and healthcare in this province, it is in one of the places we need to look is into our faith-based institutions, our not-for-profit institutions. We have had a long and rich history in that regard in this province. I believe there are 22 faith-based organizations now in the province operating, and we are in some ways very significant players. In my own health authority, faith-based institutions provide over 40% of the health care. And so that's a significant chunk. I suspect that it varies from health authority to health authority across the province. But in our health authority, it's the faith-based people who have the opportunity to bring their values and make them come alive, make them real, right at the front lines with people. And so that's a significant part of what we do. So we have a long history, and we have a long tradition with which we can work as people of faith when it comes to healthcare in this province. There are many organizations that have the history, the capability, and the mandate to bring faith and healthcare together. Part of what my job on a governance board is to develop the long-term vision that we've been talking about over this last weekend. You know, what do we want for faith and healthcare? Where do we see it going? That's what a board is supposed to do, look at the long-term, not the everyday details. Where do we want to go? Where do we want to be? And probably most importantly, how do we want to treat each other as we're getting there? And as faith-based providers, most of us say we want to treat each other in a Christ-like fashion or as a reflection of God's love and caring as we go to our vision of what a healthy society is. We don't want to step on each other or roll over each other as we're trying to get there. The challenge that governing boards of faith-based healthcare providers face is that we don't totally control the context in which we provide care. Some of that context is provided by the province, by Alberta Health and Wellness, as it sets policy and legislation, sets the budget, important things like that. And some of it is also set by our health authorities, who are our funders. Our funding comes from them. And so the question we often face as a governance board is, can we do what we want to do? Can we be who we want to be within the context that we're given, within the parameters that are provided for us? And sometimes the answer to that seems to be no. And sometimes the answer to that is yes. And so today I'm just going to work briefly from the no to the yes, from the good news to the bad news, because I'm a preacher and that's usually how we work, right? So I'm most comfortable with that mode. In terms of the bad news, I think the Marie Geddes case has really highlighted for all of us, what many of us knew for a long time, that there is a severe limitation in our context. At the Bethany Group over the last couple of weeks, when the media came to us and asked us what we thought of Marie Geddes' hunger strike and her cause, about saying that staffing levels in this province and at our facilities were low, we had to say we thought she was right. We had to say we thought she was right, that staffing levels in this province are low. And the standards are fairly low. It's a bath a week whether you need it or not, right? And so, you know, that's a challenge for us as faith-based healthcare providers, because we can balance our budgets, we can provide lean and mean care, but that's not really what we're about. We're about providing a healing community. And we're not naive to think that, you know, money can solve all our problems. That's not what we're about. We are about providing a healing community. We're about providing healing relationships. And for relationships to happen, relationships need time and space. And if you've cut everything back so far that people don't have time and space, you can't create the kind of healing relationships. And healing relationships come not only from the staff. They come from the residents. They come from the families, they come from the community, They come from the volunteers. Some of the best healing that happens in continuing care is when the grade school children come in and sing. You know, that's what healing is about in these communities. So that's the note. Sometimes we do face limitations in our context, and as a governing board, we have to struggle with, you know, can we be who we are called to be in our context? Sometimes we face a happy yes, that the context is congruent with who we are, and we can work with it, and we can work within it. The very fact that we're allowed to exist, I think, is a happy yes. That there is room in this province for faith-based healthcare providers is a happy yes. There are other happy yeses, too. In terms of continuing care, in terms of long-term care, there is a movement in this province towards something called a social model of care, and that is as opposed to sort of a medical institutional model of care. In the brief time, I'll describe these briefly, and I'm not going to do justice to either one of them. It's going to be sort of a caricature. The medical model of care was sort of the traditional sense that when you were a patient, that when you were a person in long-term care, when you weren't in there, you were considered a patient, and you were going into a hospital-like setting, right? And so as a patient, you were highly medicalized, you were expected to conform to the institution, like get up when you were told, go to bed when you're told, eat what you're told, you know, do what you're told. The staff, you were often in ward situations. The staff were highly specialized, so one person swept your floor, another person brought you your food, another person looked after your medical care needs. And there's been a move now to something called the social model, and I think it's something we as faith-based people can work with. Even our health authority encourages this, which amazes me. And in the social model, there's an understanding that when people move into continuing care, this is their home. And so new buildings are built on a more home-like setting, smaller settings. Staff are multi-skilled, so the person who makes your bed is also the person who helps you prepare your food and helps with your personal care, like it would be if you were cared for in your own home. Their food is often prepared in these smaller cottage settings, so you can, rather than in a centralized kitchen. And there's this whole move to this sense of relationship. And I think that is something we as faith-based people can work with, because we understand, one of the things we understand as faith-based people is that health occurs in relationships. I think David mentioned that this morning, that when we have a healing community, when we have good relationships with God, with ourselves, with one another, and with creation, that's the context in which health can happen. And I think one of the things is this emphasis on a social model can help us work towards that. It's something we can generate. So in terms of our faith-based not-for-profit organizations in this province where faith and healthcare are connecting, those are the sort of things we're looking at. And that's the challenges we face, is how can, at times, our context hinders us from being who we are, and at sometimes it frees us. And that's always the challenge we face in how we live out who we are. Thank you.
Now we'll pass the mic over to Carol Barwick. Carol has been a chaplain since 1992, serving a variety of facilities, including long-term care, veterans care, and for the past 6 years as chaplain of Hospice Calgary. She's a member of CAPPE, which is?
Canadian Association of Pastoral Practice and Education.
I would have been close, but not quite right on. And a graduate of the Pacific Jubilee in Spiritual Direction, or Program in Spiritual Direction. In addition to journeying with patients and families at Rosedale Hospice, Carol offers spiritual care topics of interest to Hospice Calgary Day Program and other adult outreach programs. Carol serves as a member of the Regional Home Care Ethics Committee, that's with the Calgary Healthcare Region, Consultation Team, and Ethics Education Committee. Welcome, Carol.
Well, I am very glad to be here today. And as you were told, my name is Carol Barwick. And I have the very good fortune to be the coordinator of spiritual care at Hospice Calgary. And this includes Rosedale Hospice, which is a very small 7-bed hospice that provides end-of-life care for the dying and for their families. The hospice beds are largely funded through a contractual relationship with the Calgary Health Region, and Rosedale Hospice is a non-profit, freestanding hospice that is not attached to a larger institution. It functions autonomously within the contractual requirements imposed by the primary funder. Now, Rosedale Hospice has always been a deeply spiritual place. It was consecrated as the former home of the Basilian Fathers until it was purchased for a hospice 11 years ago. And we endeavor to continue the spiritual tradition of an abbey by applying the principles of sanctuary to end-of-life care. The hospice has been operational for 9 years, and it served 1,000 patients and families during that time. So what are the elements of sanctuary? Well, sanctuary is an intent and a philosophy of care. Sanctuary is a place where world-weary travelers rest and replenish their bodies and their souls. It's a place set apart from the frenzy of the world. It's a place of peaceful quiet, of caring, of contemplation and reflection, and even reverie. Sanctuary offers both companionship and solitude. And the elements of sanctuary include the classic environmental, social, emotional, and spiritual aspects of patient care. These elements are operationalized through the built environment, through management, and through care delivery. Now, most religious groups, such as the Benedictines or the Jesuits, are ordered, and they're regulated by a rule. And a rule is the guiding principle of the group. Our rule at Rosedale Hospice is the clear intention to provide compassionate sanctuary to the dying. The intention is focused on the person, not the task. Living our commitment to our rule is not merely words but actions. Intentional patient care is shown in the reverent way we touch and handle patients' bodies and patients' spirits. It promotes a sense of safe containment in a time of great fear and uncertainty. The pace of care is carefully matched to the pace of the patient's health experience. We begin to create sanctuary as we would begin any spiritual encounter by carving out sacred time and space. The patient's individuality is honored by frequent review with the patient and family of their goals of care. And operationally, the goals of care form the basis of the QI outcome measures. But it's important to note that the outcome measurement tool is much less important than the intention and the structure it creates for ongoing conversation about well-being. The importance of this conversation is reflected in the attention that's paid to appropriate pace of care. No matter how busy the caregiver is, rushing a patient is often the function of state of mind of the caregiver. Think of a busy person in your life who, regardless of how busy they are, always seems to have enough time just for you. With intention, each individual patient is the only one who matters at that time. And it's quite possible, with intention, to be the essence of calm in the eye of the storm. We talked a bit this morning about circumstances diminishing the quality of care. And I remind you that George Washington Carver said, "I will not let someone else or their circumstances determine who I am." So with intention, we determine who we are. The rule of intention balances patient comfort, nursing care, and spiritual space in the best interest of the patient, not in the institutional routine. Intention carves out peaceful time and space to love, to be loved, and to reflect deeply on meaning. Attention to intention allows for patients and families to be deeply heard and deeply understood by all the treatment modalities. Today, many healthcare decisions are determined by economy of scale rather than humanity of scale. We see depersonalization when the unit of care is too large. We see desensitization when the task takes precedence over the person. Back in the 70s, I remember some early research indicating that we can only relate meaningfully to a small number of people at one time, and at that time they were saying seven. We can only have seven meaningful relationships in a context at one point in time. The more people that are added to the mix, the more diluted the quality of caring. So scale does influence the integrity of relationships. A humane unit of care is an organic entity able to recognize the uniqueness of each patient and family. A humane unit of care is small enough to adapt and respond to changes in the mix of constituent personalities and expressions. To accomplish this, it's necessary for decision makers to reflect individually and corporately on what it means to be a spiritual community. Sadly, medicine has become fragmented into specialties and subspecialties. And when the scale is too large or too disconnected, care becomes dispassionate and discontinuous and impersonal. Families often complain to me about acute care staff, such a simple everyday thing, throwing plastic syringe tip covers and other packaging on the floor during dressing changes and other care. And the clear message is that there's not enough time to care about the patient's environment. The medical task is more important than the person. Patients complain that if they go to the washroom before housekeeping comes, they forget and they step on the garbage, and it makes them feel disrespected. When words such as standard of care and best practice are overused, their meaning becomes blurred. Standard of care is a term that sounds like a good thing, but really, it's about how to deliver care at the lowest cost. In truth, standard of care is about minimally acceptable standard of care versus optimal standard of care or excellence. Best practice really should be about optimal care. So what is best practice when it's constrained by minimum standard of care? We claim excellence, but we deliver something different. So when we think about what is the spiritual rule or intention of the organization, we begin to take the first step in the direction of sanctuary. Quality care costs money. However, sanctuary is not entirely about dollars. It's a state of mind. It's the tone of your voice. It's the pace of your step. The spiritual time and space that you make available when you interact with those you care for. It's the contemplative pause between listening and speaking. Sanctuary is not about the size of the building or the numbers of the staff, but about the state of the caregiver's souls. The challenge is to develop the spirit of sanctuary in ourselves, in our staff, and in our institutions. Thank you.
So we're moving down through the kind of way our healthcare system is organized from a couple of organizational perspectives now to hear from Dr. Peter Niemann, a practitioner who is right at the interface with you and me. Dr. Peter Niemann obtained his undergraduate degree at the Tygerberg Hospital in Cape Town, South Africa in 1979, before moving to Calgary in 1983. He completed his residency in Alberta Children's Hospital and has been practicing as a pediatrician in Alberta since 1987. Dr. Niemann is currently on active staff at the Alberta Children's Hospital and the Rocky View General Hospital. Dr. Niemann is a faculty member at the University of Calgary as an associate assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics. In 1987, Dr. Niemann became a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons in Canada in pediatrics. He was the president of the CMDS Society, Canadian Medical and Dental Society, and is also a member of the Canadian Pediatric Society, the Alberta Pediatric Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and he sat on the Academy Advisory Board of the National Foundation of Family Research and Education. He serves on the National Advisory Committee on Physical Activity and Healthy Active Living for Children and Youth, and as a consultant to the Canadian Pediatric Society's Psychosocial Committee. He serves on the Executive Committee of the Canadian Pediatric Society's Community Pediatric Section. He also serves on the Steering Committee of the Canadian Media Awareness Network. I think Dr. Neiman has attended a lot of those healthcare meetings that Dr. Kenny referred to last night. Dr. Neiman is a respected lecturer and a regular medical contributor to local newspapers, as well as on local, national, radio, and television broadcasts. With a keen interest in patient and media education, he is the host of his website, www.healthykids.ca, a site for parents who want access to information via PowerPoint, audio, and visual seminars. He is married to Dr. Corinne Zimonski, a family doctor, and they have four children. He serves on the Physicians Resource Council for Focus on the Family. He has instructed the Dale Carnegie Training Program until 1998. He has completed 50 marathons, including two Boston marathons and two New York City marathons. Welcome, Dr. Neiman.
Well, let me just stand here by this microphone and tell you not to worry too much about what she said about me. I am just who I am. And that is a dad of four kids and a guy that's very happy doing what he's doing, being a pediatrician. And you know, when I was asked to come and talk to you this morning, I thought to myself, wow, I'm very, very blessed, lucky, fortunate, whatever the word is you want to use. Because this is clearly something that it's one of those scenarios, it's something you get to do, not something you got to do. When I wake up in the mornings, I ask myself, is my life organized in such a way as a parent? First of all, as a believer in Jesus. And secondly, as a dad. And thirdly, as a professional, is my life so organized that I'm really excited about what lies ahead? So with that in mind, I just want to tell you a very quick story that happened not so long ago. And that, I think, will illustrate what I want to share with you. There are basically just four key things that I would like to share with you. And hopefully we'll get an opportunity to field some specific questions. Because I don't want to talk to you about my agenda. I would like you to ask me questions, see if I can respond to what you want me to talk about. Well, I take you back to an average morning for me where I usually get up at 6 in the morning. The opportunity clock wakes you up. Some people call it the alarm clock, but I was told that's the wrong terminology, because when the alarm goes off, it means there's a burglary, there's a fire, there's a robbery. Now, you see, if you call it an opportunity clock, you can say, thank God, this is another opportunity to make a difference today. So the opportunity clock wakes me up at 5:59 in the mornings. And I'm ready to go. I usually go for a jog. First of all, I like to read the paper, and then afterwards I like to read God's Word so that I know what both sides are up to. And then and then I go for a run to energize me, and it's a time of reflection. I was told that Dr. David Swan, a respected colleague of mine who I've had the privilege to work with on committees and so on, said apparently this morning or recently that we as physicians don't often enough prescribe silence to our patients. And I would agree 110% with David. And so that's my moment of silence. And then it's off to the hospital, the Rocky View Hospital, where I get to, not got to, but where I get to see newborn babies. And it's hard to look at babies and not think of Psalm 139. It's tough. It's probably even tougher to think of some babies that should have been there that are not there. And I didn't think this would happen. But let me tell you that it's a joy to see these babies. And it's really good to see them and think, what is their potential? What are we touching the future stampede here? Or are we touching another Rick Warren, another pastor, or are we touching maybe somebody who's going to make a big difference in somebody else's life, even though they may be the person that cleans the floor in the hospice, whatever that may be. So to me, that's one of the exciting things, to look at these children and say to myself, God made them, first of all, and to actually get to touch them, to examine them, is a privilege. And then it's off to my office, and in that office, I tell you, I have a lot of fun. I really enjoy looking after patients, and it's fun to teach patients. The reason I do all the media things, the reason I do all the internet-based educational things is simply to be responsible. I think when we come to the end of the line, when we face our Creator one day, there's going to be two questions. The first question is, what did you do with my son, Jesus? And the second question is, what did you do with the talents that I gave you? And so when I go into my office in the mornings, I think to myself, well, you know, God has gifted me and I'm blessed. And to do a good job with families who trust you with their children is really, really an important thing. And then when I get home in the evening, it's family time. And to raise four kids is not easy. My wife is a family doctor. Kids range between ages 2 and 10. And it's a busy home. But at the end of the day, for us, you're laughing, it's an understatement, but it's again, it's a lot of fun. And I just want to go back and talk to you about really the topic that I was asked to talk about, which is how are you living the intersection of your faith and health in my specific area. So here are the four things that I want to share with you. I think all of you today at this conference, at this meeting, are here for a reason. You made the choice. You had the choice to come here or not. You decided to come. And I think when you think about it, you want to live every day to the fullest. And as far as I'm concerned, the way you start your day is critically important. It sets the tone for the whole day. How you're going to think about the day, how you're going to think about the attitude, and how you're going to reflect about your gifts and your talents. So to me, as a clinician and as a parent, I think it's vitally important to start the day with prayer. Start the day with a Bible study. Start the day with solitude. Take the time to think. I tend to be a bit of a multitask type of person, so when I run, I tend to think a lot to create opportunity. Many of you, when we talk about health and wellness and how faith may help us, many of us, and I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, I think can do better in the area of physical activity. Just going out there and doing more every day in terms of just moving and looking after the temple, looking after the body. And that's an important thing that I want to leave today with you, is the importance of not necessarily running many, many marathons, but just going for a walk. There's a saying, take the dog for a walk, even if you don't have one. And I like that saying. I like that saying. And so you have to start your day right. It sets the tone for the day. And then I think the next thing is, in this room today, I believe, are a number of people who are completely right on purpose. They will identify with what I've talked about, that if you were to ask to write a book, and I brought a book here, one of my favorite books called Loving Mondays, if you were asked to write a book like that, you would easily write it. Then also there's people in the room, unfortunately, that will write a book gladly, TGIF, thank God it's Friday, glad the week is behind them, glad that they can get away from their work. And I think it's very important for us, if we want to make a difference as people believing in God and believing in the Creator, believing in His Son, if we fit into that category, I think it's so important to live a life that is a purpose-driven life, which leads me to the book, The Purpose-Driven Life, the book by Rick Warren that is on the bestseller list. It's a book that I think has changed many, many people's lives. It's not on the bestseller list in Canada. I find it sad that it's not on the bestseller list in Canada, and yet it is for years now on the bestseller list in the United States. But in looking at the book, I just thought I'll point out a few things that stood out in the book. It's quite a bulky book, but the five or six things that I just want to focus on, for those of you that are not quite convinced about the importance of living a life that is purpose-driven, a life that you can say, I'm in the center of God's will. Yes, I did spend the time in the morning. Yes, I do talk to people who I respect. But at the end of the day, I don't have peace in my heart about where I'm going. And although I'm using a stethoscope, or although I'm visiting the sick and the dying, I'm not always sure that this is for me. And I want to encourage you to consider the benefits of a purpose-driven life. The first benefit, of course, is that it simplifies your life. And me being so busy, I always like to simplify my life and keep it a bit more simple. So I always look for quotes. And here's one quote that I want to share with you that really helped me, because I think all of us like to do our best. And sometimes to the point where we feel guilty and we judge ourselves. And here's a quote that I want to share with you. If you can't get it all done, It means you're trying to do more than God intended for you to do. That's a really good quote. I like that. If you can get everything done that you think you should be doing, you're trying to perhaps do more than what God intended for you to do. I think the Lord said in Matthew 11:28, He said, come to me, you're tired, heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And He also said, learn from me. And I think we can do that. We can learn from our Savior. And then the other thing too is in order to become effective, you have to be selective. And I think that's very important. There's so much that we can do in a healthcare setting. And I think it's very important that we decide where can we be the most effective. And so you need to be selective in order to become effective. For me this morning, I got up early, worked in the children's hospital, and slipped out of the hospital to come and honor this commitment that I would come and talk to you. I'm going back to the hospital since I'm finished this morning. But I didn't want to say no to this because I really do believe that it's so important for us to integrate our faith more and more with what we're doing. So what we do when we see patients, when we talk to them, and when we talk to colleagues of ours that are not really friendly toward people of faith, that are perhaps sometimes hostile, how do we handle that? I think there's no doubt that you want to be very, very selective in being effective. The second or the next point is that knowing your purpose helps you to focus your life. And the next point is knowing your purpose motivates you. It keeps you going. I was just talking to one of the parents of my patients before I came up to the podium earlier this morning, and we agreed that if you have a passion for something, whether it's pediatrics, nursing, palliative care, whether it's being a chaplain, they're going to be tough times. There's no doubt about it. It's not always moonshine and roses. But if you have a passion and a purpose and a dream, and if you really feel that you're in the center, the dead center of God's will, it's going to get you through those valleys. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And for those of you in the room that are not there yet, it's never too late. I have seen people, one of my favorite stories is not necessarily a spiritual story, but it's the story of Colonel Sanders, the Kentucky Fried Chicken man that was in his 70s and 80s, retired, still not happy with where he was at, and the rest is history when he really found out what he was meant to do. Now, the next point that I want to share with you is that I'm reminded, basically, at the end of the day, to be thankful. I just think that we are not, as people of faith, giving God enough gratitude at the end of the day. And really, we don't appreciate our spouses enough. We don't appreciate our children enough. We don't tell them I love you enough. We don't do that with each other enough. And the important thing is to actually keep a journal. If you don't do it yet, I'm going to ask you whether you take photographs, whether you take pictures. And most people who I've done this with before, how many of you do take photographs on holidays and birthdays and Mother's Day by a show of hands? Or holidays? Just so many hands go, majority. How many of you keep a journal? You see, less so. So I want to encourage you to actually keep a journal, because if you're going to record something visually, I think it's also very important to record something on paper. I like to write in my own writing with my fountain pen, keep a journal, which I'd like to give to my kids one day so they can kind of connect the dots of how my thoughts were. And I came across words that were expressed by a politician, perhaps not very popular in Canada, and yet this politician has a passion for faith-based initiatives. This politician is not a Canadian politician, unfortunately, or fortunately, it depends on what you think of him. I'm going to tell you later who it was. But this politician, let's put it this way, shares with us at least an interest in giving faith communities in the United States more of an opportunity to step up to the plate. And I end with some words that I came across in the newspaper that I jotted down in my journal, and then I'll share these words and sit down. This man said, there are many experiences of faith, but most will share the belief that we are loved and called to love, that our choices matter, now and forever, that there are purposes deeper than ambitions and hopes greater than success. Men and women can be good without faith, but faith is a force for goodness. Men and women can be compassionate without faith, but faith often inspires compassion. Human beings can love without faith, But faith is the great teacher of love. And I couldn't have said it better. And with that, I'm just going to sit down, and we'll get an opportunity to answer questions, I think, right? So thank you very much for your attention. I appreciate it.
We're going to move now to looking at some of our community life. And with apologies to Debbie Zimbel, because we've spelled her name wrong, and everywhere we've spelled it, I think we've spelled it differently, but it's been wrong, so our apologies. Debbie Zimbel is a parish nurse. Debbie became a nurse in 1984 after receiving a diploma in nursing, and in 1987 she completed a post-RN Bachelor of Science in Nursing degree. With 20 years of nursing experience, Debbie has specialized in community nursing, and for the past 4 years has worked as a parish nurse at Deer Park United Church in Calgary. Debbie is also trained in other holistic training modalities, including healing touch, therapeutic touch, and stress management strategies such as guided imagery. Debbie has been a Reiki master teacher since 1999. Since then, she has taught all levels of Reiki and has had several Reiki clients in her private practice. She is currently completing a specialization program in holistic nursing, level 1, with the Canadian Holistic Nurses Association. As well, Debbie volunteers with a spirituality and health research group. Debbie is most passionate about integrating spirituality and health in Western culture. Welcome, Debbie.
Thank you, Barb. Good morning, everyone. Historically, nursing and religion have been very intertwined. Nurses used to be taught how to address whole person care, including attending to the spiritual well-being of others. With the adaptation to scientific ideologies in Western medicine, attentiveness to the spiritual aspect for health was lost for nurses. However, with the resurgence of parish nursing, it's making a comeback and coming full circle. Hopefully, as research continues to improve the effectiveness of addressing the whole person to successfully heal people, this will become integrated more and more into Western medicine practice. So what is a parish nurse? I hear that a lot when I tell people I'm a parish nurse. And my definition is that a parish nurse is an integrator of faith and health within a faith community by facilitating wholeness of mind, body, and spirit, including physical, mental, emotional, relational to self, others, and God, and social dimensions. The parish nurse promotes health, and to me, that equates to optimal quality of life, encourages healing versus curing, and prevents harm, such as injury, illness, and disease. I just wanted to clarify a few points about parish nursing. Parish nursing differs from other, or most other, nursing positions because it's very intentional in addressing the spiritual dimension in relation to one's health. This position differs from being a chaplain, as a chaplain brings faith into the healthcare community, such as hospitals, long-term care, and hospices, whereas parish nursing brings health into the faith community. Parish nursing works collaboratively with others, including clergy, volunteers, and other healthcare providers. A parish nurse seeks to bring about healing versus curing, and we've heard a lot about that. But I think it's a very important distinction, and I wanted to give an example. Having worked in a hospital in the past within the Western medicine healthcare system, I used to think that we failed a patient if the patient died because we didn't save them or couldn't cure them. Now I consider it a success to have co-facilitated the process of healing with a congregant during her transition or death, and an example of that was with a recent terminal cancer patient that I worked with. This healing was in the form of a peaceful death because she was able to forgive and let go of her resentments toward her brother due to an ancestral relationship, which in turn enabled her whole family to be able to heal. Not surprisingly, her primary cancer site was in her sexual organs with metastasis to her lungs, which in traditional Chinese medicine, which is also very holistic, that's the organ system that's associated with grief. So I'm going to talk about the seven roles of the parish nurse. They include, and they're not limited to, the following. Firstly, integrator of faith and health. This, I feel, is the most important of all the roles because it interweaves throughout and connects all the other roles. For instance, helping someone make the mind-body connection that their unexplained acute shoulder pain is likely due to shouldering too many responsibilities. Secondly, health educator. For instance, teaching someone how to cope with a chronic illness or presenting health-related topics to groups such as preventing falls with the elderly, or writing articles in the church bulletin on a timely health-related topic such as West Nile virus or E. coli. Health counselor, for instance, providing pastoral care by phone or visitation, including office, home, hospital, long-term care, or outreach as requested. Referral agent, for instance, referring a woman who caretakes her adult son with seizures to the Family Caregiver Center for support and information on respite care. Liaison between congregants and community resources. For instance, accessing emergency psychiatric care with a suicidal congregant, or partnering with Calgary Health Region to initiate a collective kitchen, which assisted 12 families to meet their food security issues, or partnering with the Parent Support Association to offer the Parenting Your Teen support group. Supporter of volunteers, for instance, implementing a retreat for all the healers on the healing team so that in turn they're able to heal others, or training a volunteer leader to run a peer support program. Developer of support and wellness groups, for instance, starting a support group for women with breast cancer, or co-facilitating a weight management group by doing a modified book study of Dr. Phil's book, or initiating wellness groups such as Tai Chi, yoga, or a walking group. And lastly, health advocate. For instance, attending a medical review panel in support of a congregant with a workplace injury. So how does a parish nurse integrate faith and health? As registered nurses, we're taught to use nursing process, that is, assess, plan, implement, evaluate. So for the first phase, assessment, nursing assessment of each individual includes inquiring about the aspects of physical, mental, emotional, religious, spiritual, and social dimensions. Assessment not only includes the individuals, but also in the context of family. And each parish nurse is responsible to assess her own congregation and provide appropriate responses to those particular needs. So every parish nurse ministry is going to be completely different. Secondly, plan. The parish nurse and individual work together to clarify which issue is of greatest priority for the individual to work on and develop a strategic plan for the next steps, often with mutually agreed upon homework assigned, such as changing lifestyle choices and behaviors and following up with referrals. Thirdly, implementation. Parish nurses merely facilitate the process. They empower others to help themselves by giving them the tools. As Jesus would say, help them to fish for themselves. The healing modalities that I've listed here are the key ones that I've used as a parish nurse to facilitate spiritual care and ultimately integrate faith and health. Active listening, meaningful dialogue, presence, and compassion. And compassion is with passion. Usually this involves identifying their strengths and limitations, so a past history of what's been effective and helping them identify and resolve any barriers to success. Most importantly, it's assisting them to find clarity on the mind-body-spirit connection given their particular health situation and helping them to deal with that. Secondly is prayer. Dr. Mercola, who has a natural health site, a website, comments. His comments sum it up with his statements. There appears to be no question that prayer works. We have many studies now that document that. The science is very solid in peer-reviewed publications. The science is so solid that it is criminally negligent for physicians not to recommend it. And talk about cost-effective. There is no cost to prayer except for time. Thirdly, stress management strategies. Approximately 80% of all illnesses in developed countries are caused from stress. Given this information, stress management strategies could be our greatest health promotion tool in North America. So we as parish nurses teach strategies such as deep breathing exercises, guided imagery, meditation, progressive muscle relaxation, mindfulness, and awareness. From a spiritual perspective, when we quiet our minds, we become connected to God. As scripture says, be still and know that I am God. And we spoke about that this morning when we experience silence. From a purely medical perspective, these strategies promote the relaxation response, causing a whole beneficial domino effect. Decreased blood pressure and heart rate, extra oxygen to the brain, so clearer thinking, improved memory, focus, and concentration, and improved immune function. And the list goes on and on. And there are no negative side effects. I personally, because I'm trained in therapeutic touch and healing touch and Reiki, also utilize energy healing modalities, but not all parish nurses do that. So I do integrate therapeutic touch into my practice as well. And the last stage is evaluate. On subsequent visits, we evaluate the effectiveness of what was implemented and mutually modify the plan as necessary and appropriate. For example, with an individual healing from depression, all aspects need to be addressed as follows. Physically, is the patient getting enough rest, exercise, sunlight, and are his basic needs being met for survival? Is he on any medications, and are they effective? Mentally, what triggered the depression, and is there any family history of depression? Emotionally, is he suffering from loss or grief, which may have precipitated the depression? Spiritually, is this a spiritual crisis related to perceived lack of meaning or purpose in his life, and what is the meaning of the depression to him? Socially, what support networks does he have, or is he socially isolated? And how can the faith community support him? In summary, a parish nurse promotes health and healing by integrating faith and health within a faith community, and in so doing practices a whole person health perspective. Modalities utilized by a parish nurse, such as prayer, presence, compassion, meaningful dialogue, and stress management techniques are cost-effective and have only beneficial side effects. As I said, there are no negative side effects. And in my experience, parish nursing is successful and it works. Thank you.
Jerry Carter is going to be our last speaker and is speaking from a place that likely many of us can relate to, that interface where it becomes upfront, close, and personal. Jerry Carter is the executive director of Phoenix Safe House, the emergency women's shelter in Medicine Hat. She's a member of Holy Family Roman Catholic Parish, a Rotarian, a director on the Alberta Council of Women's Shelters, and a very active advocate for the prevention of family violence. From a health point of view, Jerry is a breast cancer survivor and suffers from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. She's also experienced a heart attack. Despite her health problems, she maintains a healthy lifestyle and a busy life. Jerry is the widow of the late Bob Carter, the mother of two grown sons, Mark and Michael Grip, and the grandmother of two handsome little boys. Her third son, Matt, died about 5 years ago. The friend who provided this biography said Jerry is an amazing cook, specializing in Mexican food, an avid reader, a tasteful decorator, and a loyal friend. She shares her home with a Shih Tzu named Corky. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you, Robin, for that lovely introduction. You'll have to excuse me, I'm not feeling as prepared as my esteemed speakers before me. I just came from 2 days of an inquiry in Red Deer over the death of a mom and child that were told that they had to turn over their children for visitations, even though the person was armed and dangerous. So that has clogged up my thinking, and my heart is heavy because I was in the courtroom with this woman's surviving children, and it was hard. It was very hard. So if I'm a little bit scattered, it's because my heart is with the family in Red Deer, and I just listened to 2 days' worth of inquiry. I have a favorite saying. It seems like everybody has a favorite saying. And I had wanted to get up when David Swan was up here speaking, saying I wanted my saying on the microphone as well. And the one that has been on my refrigerator for the last 15 years, and I cut it out of a magazine, and it was timely right after my husband died in 1992. And it says, the rent we pay for our place on earth is the service that we give to others. And I really tried to live my life by those words. I'm fortunate enough to have a son that's in his third year of medical school, and I get to, and he's in the United States on the East Coast, and I get to call him every week and tell him what kind of doctor I think he should be. So when I talk to my son and we're talking about procedure, I talk about, Mark, make sure when you have that patient across, sitting across from you, that you look her in the eye. I've had experiences where the doctor has never looked up from the file because he's got 100 people waiting in the office. And I know that I've had a good appointment by the way I feel when I walk out of that building. And lots of times it's not very good. It's not very good. I'm very depressed. But if I have a doctor that's going to look at me in the eye and make me feel like I've been heard, I feel like I've had a successful visit. So I get to tell Mark once a week, Mark, it doesn't cost anything when that person is shaking after some disheartening news to reach over and pat them on the shoulder, pat them on the arm. That does not take a lot of time. Make people feel human. I've worked with abused women and children for the last 15 years, so sometimes it's really hard for me to separate my life from theirs and the work I do from my home life, because I have such tremendous respect and courage for women that come into our place of residence. I'm also fortunate enough to be able to facilitate women's groups, and in that I know that that person cannot be healed if we're just taking away the violence. We need to treat that entire person. And as I was listening to the spirituality piece, we start every group with an affirmation, a positive thing. We start every group with going around the room and letting their voices be heard. People that don't have their voices heard, that is a feeling of such disenfranchisement. It's just, I have seen women come into the shelter in crisis on 5 different mood-altering drugs because a physician has not wanted to take the time to ask if there's violence in the home. I have seen children come in with Ritalin that are actually children exposed to family violence, and nobody has listened to them. You really cannot heal as a person if there is no one to listen. Fortunately enough, I come from a faith background. I'm always telling the clients that I see when they think there is no hope, that when all the doors seem shut and it seems like there's barriers everywhere, God will always open a window. And I told this one person that when her house had burned down, she didn't have any family support. There were just all kinds of trauma things happening in her life. And I said, God's going to open a window. And the next day it snowed, and there was a group of women from one of the local churches that came with supplies and lots of hugs and meals and things. And I saw her outside, and I wondered what she was doing because her arms were flapping, and she was making snow angels outside. And for me, that is part of the way that I heal. I have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I know what the future holds for me. But I also know that I have a lot of strength and a lot of courage and a lot of compassion that I can give to other people. I think one of the important things I wanted to say as well is that we're such a mobile society, and I myself have my family in the United States. I have one son on the East Coast. So it's very hard to actually garner that level of support that sometimes I think I need. I have to go out and make myself connect with my friends and make myself connect with my God. And when you think about people in crisis, think about their level of support and what we can do to assist these people with feeling connected to the larger society. And I'll say it again, if I'm repeating myself, people want their voices heard. I just finished reading a book about a mother's courage and a little boy's strength, and it is called We Are All the Same. And this was about a little boy from Africa that was dying of AIDS. And his mother passed on the disease to him. And sometimes I thought, when my faith wanes, as it often does, I think about this little boy. And so the mother knew she was going to die, and she knew there was not enough hostages or refugee camps or centers for her to stay. So what she did is she dropped this little boy off on the doorstep of one of the camps, and he was picked up and given maybe 3 months to survive. And this British lady, a Christian lady, picked him up, saw something special in this child, took him home, raised him as her own. He did live to be 12 years old, and he did live to be a spokesperson at the International World Conference on AIDS. In the book, it talks about him meeting Nelson Mandela. And oftentimes when I think, oh my God, I've got non-Hodgkin's, what's the future face for me? How am I going to survive? How am I going to cope? How am I going to help other people? I think we are all the same. We just want our voices to be heard. Like I said, I feel not prepared like my esteemed colleagues on the panel. But I will say something that I always start a staff meeting with, and that's something by Margaret Mead, which I'm sure a lot of people recognize this. Never let it be said that a small group of people cannot change the world, because indeed that's the only thing that really does. And so I encourage you to speak out, let your voices be heard. You can and will change the world. Thank you.
I'd like to express a profound thank you to each of you for sharing with us from your passion and your experience. The passion that each of you bring came through very clearly, and I think we've all been touched by that. Your vocations are very different, but I heard some very common themes. The process of walking with individuals through health and illness is standing on holy ground, and it is a privilege. But also, what is most meaningful and what is most beneficial costs only time and intention. Listening and actually hearing one another, prayer, the self-discipline of self-care, solitude and reflection, these cost each of us only time, and yet in terms of healing, these are the foundations. So I would encourage, as we move into the dialogue that we'll be having, to take what you've heard from the speakers and think about it, build on it. Dietmar will talk about the breakout groups and how we're going to assemble. So I'll turn it over to Dietmar.